You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, some 2020 Democrats are already staking out Wisconsin as a big part of their presidential campaigns. We'll talk to a political analyst about what the state's role is shaping up to be in election 2020. First, opening day for the Milwaukee Brewers is 24 days away. Doesn't look like it outside. After losing to the Dodgers in Game 7 of the National League Championship Series last year, the team has high hopes of getting back to the postseason, maybe even winning a World Series. So while there's reason to be fans to be excited, there's also reason to be nervous about the health of Major League Baseball. It's been the second straight offseason in which star players didn't get deals until after spring training began. That's causing some above-average players to have to wait as well and sign for contracts way below what their market value was thought to be. They're not happy about that, and some players say they're ready to burn the system down and strike when the current collective bargaining agreement runs out in 2 years. Bob Nightingale is the Major League Baseball columnist for USA Today. Bob, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Sure, my pleasure, Rob.
Well, some headlines out there, Bob, a quiet offseason out there, and then some big money, high-profile deals. Can you give us the storyline of what happened this winter in baseball free agency?
Yeah, it was just a waiting game. I mean, some players, you know, turned down contracts early on in the winter they wish they had taken. It was a waiting game. People are kind of, evaluating players differently now. They're kind of holding off but giving long-term contracts to players at the age of 30 or older. They're getting gun-shy about giving long-term contracts. You know, the two stars finally did get their money in Bryce Harper and Manny Machado. But, you know, like you said, it took into spring training. But they did get paid $630 million. It just took forever to get it.
And for those veteran players who aren't those marquee names, but, you know, have had some all-star appearances, they're good, quality players, what is the market looking like for them right now?
There are still some very good players out there, you know, such as Dallas Keuchel, the former Cy Young winner that helped lead the Astros to a World Series championship 2 years ago. Craig Kimbrell, considered the top closer in baseball, sort of the most consistent closer. He's still without work and no one really biting right now. So there's still some good players out there. And, you know, it's left players, the Players Association, very frustrated.
Yeah, so let's talk about that frustration. This isn't something that baseball isn't going on strike this year, but what is it that has players upset enough to be talking about, when the current contract ends, maybe they strike?
Well, just that teams aren't paying players what they used to. You know, average salary went down last year. When, there's almost $11 billion in revenue in Major League Baseball. So, players were getting more money, a few years ago than they're getting now. So that's a frustration. Frustration is you play, six, 7 years, and all of a sudden after, getting some good money as a player before you're a free agent, you turn free agent, and so all of a sudden your phone doesn't even ring. So I'm very frustrated about that.
Talking to Bob Nightingale, Major League Baseball columnist for USA Today. And I've seen, Bob, some players accusing teams in the league of tanking, basically not trying to compete for good players, not trying to necessarily even win games, save money now, maybe get some higher draft picks in the future. Is that legit? Is that actually happening?
Yeah. I mean, you have about a third of the teams in baseball, Rob, who aren't even trying to win. They're actually more interested in getting a top draft pick. So that's a frustration for players, too, is that, you do have teams, like the Brewers and St. Louis Cardinals and Cubs trying to win, but you have other teams like Miami and others who are trying to just completely rebuild. And that has, players frustrated, it's a real free agent market when you want 30 teams after you, not just, one or two. And that's what happened with Machado and Harper. Is at the end, they only had two or three teams that were really interested.
And we have this thing in Major League Baseball. It's not a salary cap like in National Football, but they have what they call a luxury tax. It says, if a team spends over this much, they pay a fine, in effect, to the league. Is that something that is making teams spend less and having an impact on what players end up getting paid?
Yeah, absolutely. The only two teams that had that paid the luxury tax last year that went over, that was the Boston Red Sox, who was about $12 million over. I'm sorry, about $40 million over, in the Washington Nationals are just a couple million dollars more. Everybody else is under.
Is this
salary cap? We should have, you know, people said maybe we should have a salary for them.
So, big picture, Bob, a strike obviously would affect fans' experience of the game, but that's a maybe, and it's a couple years away. With the way teams are approaching competing for players or maybe not competing for players, is this affecting the product? Is this something that fans, especially in some of these markets that aren't competing, are looking and saying, hey, yeah, I'm not seeing as good a quality a game as I used to?
No, absolutely. There's a lot of fans that, you know, in different cities, you have no chance of winning. And, you know, they have the payroll, you know, almost $100 million below the luxury tax. So this is been very flat. You know, it was actually down last year, the lowest it's been in about 10 years. So I think part of that is just we don't have great competition, those great pennant races.
We'll leave it there for now, Bob. Thanks for joining us today.
Sure, my pleasure. Thank you, Rob.
That's Bob Nightingale, Major League Baseball columnist at USA Today. We talked to them about some of the big dollar contracts that have been handed out recently and the possibility of a labor strike in 2021. Coming up, we'll move up a year. We'll talk about why some 2020 Democratic presidential candidates are already saying they're going to prioritize Wisconsin. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, feeling guilty for indulging your sweet tooth over the weekend? We'll hear one dietitian's approach to having a healthy relationship to food, one that means you don't have to feel guilty for having a dessert now and then. First, the 2020 presidential election is still more than a year and a half away, but some Democrats are already showing up here in Wisconsin. Former Texas Congressman and Senate candidate Beto O'Rourke spent some time in Milwaukee and Madison last month, and when Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar was in Eau Claire last month, here's what she had to say.
What I've decided to do in our state and what I do all around the country as I run this campaign is go to places that maybe we didn't focus on enough in the last few years.
This focus on Wisconsin comes after Hillary Clinton was criticized for not campaigning here in 2016, and it signals that some Democrats will have a different approach this time around. Mordecai Lee is professor emeritus of urban planning at UW-Milwaukee and a former state lawmaker. Mordecai, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Rob. Glad to be here.
Well, before we hit 2020, take us back to 2016. Did Hillary Clinton get a lot of criticism for not visiting Wisconsin, given that she ended up losing the state to Donald Trump?
Well, let me give you a minority opinion about this. It's become the conventional wisdom of the Beltway media and, you know, talk shows that she lost Wisconsin because she didn't campaign here any time between getting the nomination of her party and the election, and that therefore there were enough Wisconsinites who decided not to vote for her. I really think that that's an oversimplification and verges on the absurd. She barely lost Wisconsin. It was 20,000 votes. But on the other hand, George W. Bush barely lost Wisconsin when it was his turnaround, or simply a close state. You know, try to imagine, I want to meet the voter who says, well, I usually vote Democratic, and I usually vote in presidential elections, and I was going to vote for Hillary Clinton, but because she didn't campaign here personally, I'm not going to vote. I mean, that stretches credulity.
And I've seen arguments that, okay, look at Pennsylvania. Both candidates visited there quite a bit. The Democrats didn't keep that state. Colorado, I think Donald Trump visited more than Hillary Clinton, and it went the other way. Those visits maybe aren't the be-all and end-all.
You know, Rob, I'm really glad you're mentioning this because we're preventing this oversimplification and this generalization. And if I recall correctly, the Clinton campaign had a ground game in Wisconsin. They had something like a dozen field offices and 24 paid staffers. They had visits here by Tim Kaine, her running mate. They had visits, I think it was by Joe Biden and by former President Clinton. They were not walking away from Wisconsin. They weren't taking Wisconsin for granted.
Will Democrats be paying a lot of attention to Wisconsin this time around, given what happened last time?
I think the answer to that question is yes and no. I think that whoever becomes the Democratic nominee will be paying a lot of attention to Wisconsin. And who's ever still standing when it comes to our April presidential primary, they'll be visiting Wisconsin a lot. But up to that point, it's not very logical to campaign in Wisconsin. I mean, I know some people have a very low opinion of politicians and campaigns, but campaigns and politicians are the ultimate rational decision-making kind of entity. if there's only 24 hours in a day and they've got to do well in Iowa and they've got to do well in New Hampshire and then they've got to do well in South Carolina, you know, you can see where I'm going. The calendar dictates where they spend their time because time isn't fungible. So I really don't expect much between now and sort of the last 2 weeks before the April primary.
Looking at the general election, though, people are starting to put up those electoral college maps, and it looks like the Democrats are going to have a really hard time winning overall if they don't win Wisconsin. Is that a fair statement?
I think that's a fair statement, especially if we try to avoid being geocentric about sort of we're the center of the world. I think generally speaking, what you'd find national analysts saying is that it comes down to winning Wisconsin and Michigan and Ohio and then toss in Pennsylvania. In other words, that sort of mid-America, Midwest, central time zone mostly, that they have to win. And so that's where I think we become important. We become part of a kind of a package of appealing to the Midwest.
Now, Mordecai, some things got flipped on their heads a couple years back. It used to be for a long time we said Democrats did better in Wisconsin in presidential election years. Republicans did better in off years. Now we have Donald Trump winning Wisconsin in the presidential election year, Republicans winning a Senate seat or keeping one then. Then in the off year, a Democratic candidate for governor wins Wisconsin. Democratic candidate for Senate is reelected. We just flip things around. What's going on?
Rob, you've been around too long because I'm sure you could
probably.
I'm sure you could find a tape of me on your show saying that. that it's true that elections, high turnout elections, in other words, presidential, skew Democratic because you've got below average voters turning out, and that midterm gubernatorial elections skew Republican because you've got above average voters turning out. These were both close elections. The governor's race could just as easily have been won by Scott Walker. The presidential race could just as easily have been won by Mrs. Clinton. So I think it's just the randomness of politics, of things getting down to 20,000 votes, 50,000 votes out of a couple million, that it's practically a random outcome.
Talking to Mordecai Lee, emeritus professor at UW-Milwaukee, looking at Wisconsin and election 2020. Some Democratic presidential candidates declared and otherwise already planning their visits. The Democratic Party of Wisconsin saying they're hearing a lot of interest from campaigns. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Does it make a difference to you personally if a candidate comes and visits the state? Does that influence your decision to vote for them? Does it get you more excited? Call in at 800-642-1234. And if you're hoping Democrats win, what kind of candidate do you want to see nominated? If you're hoping Republicans win, what kind of Democratic candidate do you want to see nominated? Call 800-642-1234. Mordecai, Craig Gilbert in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel was writing about Wisconsin's undecided voters. For liberals and Democrats, he found, at least according to the surveys he's looking at, liberals and Democrats are very much decided already. There are some undecided voters who are conservative-leaning independents. There are Republicans who are not sure about Donald Trump. Can you talk about who might be undecided in a Wisconsin presidential vote?
Right. Craig is an outstanding reporter, and he was basing that report on the Marquette Law School polls that are directed by Charles Franklin, who's really Wisconsin's best pollster. So I think we should give high credibility to his interpretation. Probably what's going to happen is that people are going to be tugged and pulled the closer they get to November. In other words, it'll resume being a binary choice. Last time around in the presidential election, you had lots of Republicans who said prior to the election, I really don't like Donald Trump. I really don't like Donald Trump. But then it came down to, well, are you really going to vote for Hillary Clinton? Are you really going to like her Supreme Court nominations? And so I think there was a layer in this layer cake, a thin layer of Republican voters that you described, probably college-educated, probably suburban, probably white, who said, okay, I'll hold my nose. I'm going to vote for the Republican nominee because I'm going to like his Supreme Court appointments. And I sort of think people are going to come back home in the same way. But nonetheless, in Wisconsin, there are authentically undecided voters, the ones that you described. And so Wisconsin is winnable by both parties in this presidential cycle, as it's been really for like George W. Bush and for Hillary Clinton.
You mentioned earlier ground game and the presidential campaign's ground game. What about here in Wisconsin? I think it's conventional wisdom that Republicans have a better, more established party structure. They're better at doing this election stuff than Wisconsin Democrats as an organization are. Is that fair, and why is that, if so?
I think that's very fair, and I think it's because people who skew Republican tend to be above average in age and income and education. And as a result of that, you might call them automatic voters. In other words, it doesn't take a huge ground game to be sure that they turn out to vote. You want to have a good setup so that, let's say, around noon of Election Day, if somebody hasn't turned out, you call them, you send a car, whatever it might be. With Democrats for a presidential election, we're talking about irregular voters, people who are below average in age and income and education. So for the Democratic Party, it's a bigger lift to get them to vote. And that's why the Democratic Party needs a bigger ground game in presidential elections than Republicans do.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Gary is with us in Fitchburg. Gary, hello.
Hello there. I've followed Democratic politics for many, many years and supported people like George McGovern and, you know, folks like that. I wonder what happened to the Dems with regard to military spending. It's just gone crazy, and our involvement overseas is staggering. We have 36,000 troops, I think, in Germany or something. But I think the Dems have been distracted by things like the monument issue, the trans issue, and supporting the border, you know, more immigration.
Gary, thanks a lot for the call. A lot there, Mordecai. Let's talk about military spending and having troops overseas. Usually there are at least some voices in the Democratic Party saying pull back troops, less U.S. involvement in military efforts overseas. Now we have a Republican president who's saying similar things, largely due to the cost. How has that flipped around?
I think it's really great that Gary is reminding us that the Democratic Party's agenda has changed, because when he's referring to McGovern, we can remember the party slogans, things like we have to change priorities. We need to spend less on the military and more on domestic needs. That was really the reaction to the Vietnam War. But what I think has changed is that Democrats really got burned by George W. Bush and the accusations that Dems were soft on military spending, soft on national security, soft on terrorism. And so now on that issue, they've sort of become the Me Too party. That, no, we're not soft on national defense, or we're not soft on terrorism. It's almost like they're afraid to engage in that. But Gary is right that used to be a real main calling card of the Democratic Party.
Gary, thanks for that call. Gary also mentions what, if I can summarize, is a debate within the Democratic Party among Democrats over should we focus on so-called identity politics. Gary gave a couple of examples there. Or economic issues, some people pushing back saying you can kind of do both. But looking at the field of candidates so far, Mordecai, how do you see that playing out?
Well, what I like about the field of candidates is it's sort of like 31 flavors. If any voter out there will say, I found somebody I like. I don't think there's going to be a Democratic primary voter who says, I don't like all 31 of them or whatever it might be. And it's really hard to predict the choreography, sort of who falls first and who falls second, and how does the field narrow down. You know, on the Republican side, the field narrowed down to a standard conservative versus Trump. I'm not sure what will happen in terms of the Democrats. Will it be a standard old-fashioned liberal versus kind of a new Dem? Will it be somebody who's going for identity politics or going for ideology, sort of the hard left base? It really depends. By the time we get to voting here in Wisconsin, I'm really not sure, but I'm guessing that we're going to have one from each silo. We're going to have an identity politics, we're going to have an old-fashioned liberal, and we're going to have somebody who's very ideological with the old-fashioned base.
Now I want ice cream. Thanks for the 31 flavors reference. Let's talk about the Donald Trump factor. For all the talk about him being a unique candidate who is, for better or worse, changing the way we talk about politics, talk about political alignment, some people have looked at the outcome of the last election and said if you had generic Republican, a lot of the vote outcomes might have looked pretty similar.
I think that's true, but Donald Trump spoke to a base of the Republican Party that had been taken relatively casually previously before that, he really excites a certain category. While at the same time, he turns off another category of Republican voters or general election voters. You know, I think we should think about a scenario that he wants to run for re-election. He really prefers politics over policy. And I remember when I was in the state legislature, I was astonished to meet members of the state legislature who liked politics more than policy. You could probably say about Obama that he liked policy more than he liked politics. But in any event, he wants to run for re-election, but there are issues about his electability, about his popularity. Some people might raise the age issue. I think there's a chance, I wouldn't put a number on it, I think there's a chance that he will end up not being the Republican nominee for president, in which case it, of course, becomes a whole new ballgame.
All right, let's somebody pull that tape, and if that happens, we'll talk about what a genius Mordecai was. And if it doesn't, we'll all forget about it. Mordecai, are you expecting to see President Trump flipping things around in our last minute, coming here to Wisconsin a lot as we approach the general election?
Absolutely. He won Wisconsin. He wants to win Wisconsin, assuming that he runs again. And so he'd want to lay the groundwork. He loves doing these rallies rather than sitting in the White House sitting through boring briefings.
We'll leave it there. Mordecai, thanks, as always, for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. Bye.
We've been talking to Mordecai Lee, Professor Emeritus of Urban Planning at UW-Milwaukee. He's a former state lawmaker. He joined us to talk about what Wisconsin's role will be in the 2020 presidential campaign, as we've already started to get a couple campaign visits from Democratic candidates or likely candidates. Coming up, we'll hear from a dietitian who says we should stop worrying about what we eat and think more about why. We'll talk about how to create a normal relationship with our food. You can join the conversation before it even starts. Head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page. We got a question up there on this topic. Let us know what you think. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7:30 on the morning show, Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes joins Kate Archer Kent for a look at the state budget and other top priorities for the new administration. It's tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, we all have a different relationship with food. Some of us might be focused on counting calories. Others might feel some guilt after eating something sugary or get stressed and skip meals or get stressed and eat even more. Our next guest says that all of this attention to what we're eating can have negative effects. Instead, we should focus on when and why we eat to get closer to what she calls a normal relationship with food. Abby Langer is a registered dietitian and has worked in clinical nutrition and nutrition media and consulting. She writes about debunking fad diets and nutrition myths on her website, abbylangernutrition.com. She wrote the piece, "This is what it looks like to have a normal relationship with food," for self.com. Abby, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, what do you mean by a normal relationship with food?
Now, it's important to know that normal and healthy are two completely different things. This doesn't mean having a normal relationship with food doesn't mean you eat a lot of salads and, you know, you cut down on your sugar. Normal is more along the lines of knowing why you eat and having a healthy attitude towards food and a healthy relationship with food.
A lot of us don't. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, that's something that affects most of us at one point or another, and some for longer than others. You know, we have such a diet culture, and there's this thin ideal that a lot of people or most of us strive for. And, you know, it really takes a toll on our relationship with food, because we're using all these external cues to sort of achieve something, some arbitrary idea of how we should look and how we should feel. And in doing that, we ignore what our bodies are telling us.
How do we tune ourselves into what our bodies are telling us?
So I think the first step is to understand what those external cues are, and to take a look at you know, the way you perceive food and eating. If you're saying, you know, this food is bad and this other food is good and I'm eating clean and, you know, I'm such a horrible person because I ate this cake, that those are symptoms of being basically under the influence of a diet mentality. So I think the first step would be to understand that we need to step away from that diet mentality by knowing that it's normal to eat and it's normal to feel hungry, and that guilt and shame do not play well with food and eating ever.
Abby Langer is with us, registered dietitian, talking about having a normal relationship with food. Abby, you have a manifesto up on your website, and one of the points on there has to do with that shame and the guilt that I think a lot of people feel after some bit of indulgence or another. How does that hurt us?
Well, it makes us eat more. In the end, a lot of the time, because we feel so bad about ourselves, you know, and research has shown that people who feel guilt and shame around eating actually tend to eat more. And I think it's important to note the shame and guilt around food it hurts us because when we feel that a food is shameful or we feel guilty or after we eat it, or that a food is good or it's bad, we tend to internalize those labels to ourselves. So let's say you eat a piece of cake and you think it's such a bad food. People tend to think, I'm eating a bad food and therefore I am bad. And it's a terrible thing, because obviously intellectually we know we're not bad people for eating a piece of cake, but this is how diet culture works.
Now, suppose, as you said, normal doesn't necessarily mean the same as healthy eating. I could envision a world in which I ate lots of donuts and managed to erase my shame. I could eat a lot of bad food in a way that makes me unhealthy. How do I make sure that, you know, getting rid of that shame, feeling normal about how I eat, doesn't turn too unhealthy?
You know, I think it's important to respect your body and to respect your hunger and fullness cues. And that's what normal eating entails, is to respect your body by choosing mostly nourishing foods. It's not an excuse for a free-for-all with donuts or pizza, although no food is restricted, which can be very difficult for people. You know, I tell people, people always ask me, what food would you never eat, or what food should we never eat? And I don't have an answer for that. I mean, I really eat everything as a dietitian. I still eat Oreo cookies. I still eat pizza. But is my diet based on those things? No, but I don't feel bad when I eat that. That's normal eating. I mean, I think, you know, we've been on restrictive diets with such long lists of rules for so long that we're so afraid to integrate less nourishing foods into our diets. But just choosing mostly nourishing foods and understanding when we don't choose those foods, that it's totally normal. As long as, you know, you don't do it every single meal.
Why do we love really restrictive or unusual diets? Because it seems like we really gravitate toward those. Is it just like the no pain, no gain thing? We want to feel like we're suffering to do better?
I think there's a couple of reasons. I mean, I think people are really out for a quick fix, and they feel as though if something's really strange or they haven't heard of it before, maybe it's just that one thing that's going to do the trick. Although if you ask people to really sit and think about it intellectually, they will know, most of them will tell you that it probably won't work. I also think there's a need to belong. And I write about this all the time, where, you know, diets are getting more extreme. Their newest one is the carnivore diet, where people eat nothing but meat and salt and water. And that's it. They don't eat. They think vegetables are horrible for you. It's just a very restrictive, obviously, diet. And I think it comes from the need to belong to one of these diet tribes. We are so connected in the world, yet we're so alone. And studies have shown that we're actually lonelier than ever before, even though everyone's connected via the internet and all of that. And I think, you know, it's a substitute for actual interpersonal relationships, is feeling like you're part of a group, that you're doing something special, that you have some special knowledge of this diet. It's like a special club. It makes people feel supported.
We're talking to registered dietitian Abby Langer. She writes about debunking fad diets, nutrition myths, and more at her website, abbylangernutrition.com. She says we need to try to rebuild a more normal relationship with our food. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you? Do you feel like you've been stressed, felt stressed because of the food you eat, the foods you avoid? Have you found an approach to eating that works for you? Why do you think we respond to stress, boredom, fatigue, whatever, with eating? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up that conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Abby Langer, a registered dietitian. She wrote the piece, "This is what it looks like to have a normal relationship with food," for self.com. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel guilty after maybe eating a big meal or a sweet treat? How would you like to change your relationship with food, or have you done that? Do you feel better about things now? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Taylor is with us in Madison. Taylor, hi.
Hi, thanks so much. I just wanted to say that I've been down that road of restrictive diets, like the low carbs, lots of meat and vegetables. But at the same time, you know, I've now come to a more healthy approach with food, of loving all kinds of food, you know. So, and that includes having cake and beer and cheese curds. And from that result, it's just been I'm a much more loving relationship with myself and food, because those restrictive diets are just so stressful. And you should enjoy food. That's what it's there for.
Taylor, thanks a lot for the call. Abby, what do you think?
I think that's so fantastic. I'm just nodding as Taylor's talking, and I love how she said cheese curds, because you're in Wisconsin. I'm
we
in
sure
Toronto.
Are.
I think that's so fantastic, and it's so great to hear from someone who's been through everything and then come out the other side and has found peace and a good relationship with food and with your body. I think that's so awesome.
Taylor, thanks a lot for the call. We'll go now to Lynn with us in Bayview. Lynn, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. How are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Lynn?
Well, ever since I was a kid, my parents wanted to feed me breakfast, lunch, and supper, and their menu. But I always objected to that. I ate what I wanted, when I wanted. Drove them crazy. But I'm 52, and I weigh the same as I weighed in high school. And I always eat what I want, when I want to. So if I want chicken soup for breakfast, that's what I eat.
Yeah.
If I want a salad at midnight, that's what I eat. And I don't do societal norms. Like, you have to eat 3 meals a day. I might eat 8 meals a day. They might be really tiny meals, but they're what I want. So I just pay attention to what I want to eat, and that's what I eat.
Lynn, thank you so much. Abby, it sounds like you're nodding along there again.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I love it.
And that makes me think of, I'm a parent myself, and I've been there, that stressful, almost combat zone with the kids, trying to get them to eat the good stuff when the parent wants. I'm as guilty as Lynn's parents were of that. How can we get past that as parents?
Well, first of all, stop referring to food as good or bad, because there is no good or bad food. And I think also it's important to set a good example for our kids. So if they see you eating the foods that you want them to eat, then they will more likely than not eat them. But I always tell clients, if you make it a big deal, it's going to be a big deal. You know how kids, when you tell them to do something, they never want to do it. But if you just leave them alone, then they're more likely to do whatever you want them to do. So if, for example, you want them to eat broccoli, you put it on their plate. If they eat it, that's great. Don't say anything. If they don't eat it, that's fine. Don't say anything. Just take it away and continue to offer them the foods that you want them to eat. I think it's also important to make the connection between the way kids eat and the way we eat, because kids are naturally intuitive with their eating. They're born eating when they're hungry and then stopping when they're full. And they eat what they want, and then they don't eat what they don't want. So they won't just see a burger and think, oh, I'm not hungry, but I'm going to eat that anyways because it looks good. If they're not hungry, they're not going to eat it. So, and then we lose those internal, they're operating on their internal hunger and fullness cues. We don't do that because we're affected by so many outside influences. So it's almost like I'm saying eat more like a child, except, you know, eat more vegetables. But yeah, so it's interesting to watch kids eat. But setting a good example, not making a big deal about what they're eating or what they're not eating, and knowing that nothing bad's going to happen if the kid hates vegetables for a couple of years. Like, just relax. They know when you're stressed. If they know you're stressed, it's going to work against you.
Thanks a lot for that call. Mm-hmm. Jonathan joins us in Janesville now. Hello, Jonathan.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
What's your story, Jonathan?
About 10 years ago, I lost about 100 pounds. Most of my adolescence, I was obese. And my whole journey was based on learning to love food and appreciate food. And eventually I went to culinary school and developed this love a little bit more. But in this country, we don't have a real connection with real food. We don't love food the way that many other cultures around the world do. And that's something that I've found, that developing that love and understanding of food and cooking has allowed me to be able to enjoy food anytime, and so to have a real relationship with food that we don't, you know, that we don't currently have in this country. And yeah.
Jonathan, thank you so much for sharing that. I think a lot of times, Abby, especially when we're talking about obesity, the approach is to shun food, battle with food, view food as the enemy. Jonathan did exactly the opposite and did pretty well, it sounds like.
I think it's so, having just been to Italy for the second time, I know exactly what he's talking about, because the food there is so beautiful and they really appreciate the beauty of food. Here it's like, let's just eat in the car on the way to work and, you know, not even taste their food. A lot of things are ultra processed. Couldn't be more different over there. And I think that's a great way to eat, the way most European countries eat.
Jonathan, thank you so much for sharing your experience. Abby, how do we get there from here? For people who are stressed out, they feel shame about the food they eat, they're watching for the superfood and the food to avoid. Yeah. How do we get from there to that normal relationship?
You know that there's no quick fix, and know that you can trust your body. And it's a process. And, you know, I know that the way I'm saying it is making it sound like I think it's easy, but I don't think it's easy. Of course not. And if you've been eating a certain way for your whole life or for the majority of your adult life, it's very hard to then shut off the diet behaviors and to start trusting your body. But know that your body will ask for food when you're hungry, and it will give you satiety cues, like fullness cues, when it's full. And if you eat the majority of your food whole or minimally processed, then you should have some satisfaction with the foods that you're eating. But also know that it's not worth it to beat yourself up about eating in the way that the diet culture says is bad. Like, there's no good foods, bad foods. You are not your diet. And food isn't the enemy or something to be feared. We're so afraid of eating. And I want people to revel in the beauty of food and have a good relationship with food and their bodies. It takes time.
Abby, thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Abby Langer, registered dietitian. She's worked in clinical nutrition and nutrition media and consulting. She writes about debunking fad diets and nutrition myths on her website, abbylangernutrition.com. She wrote the piece, "This is what it looks like to have a normal relationship with food for self.com. Still time for you to share your story. We have a question up at the Ideas Network Facebook page. If you have a story, maybe like some of our callers today, you can share that. Just head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Over half of Wisconsin children live in a child care desert, meaning there's only one slot of licensed child care for every three kids. One big reason for that is a shortage of child care workers, as Phoebe Petrovic reports that shortage has gotten much worse just over the last 3 years.
A couple dozen children are toddling over the snow. They're bulky in coats and snow pants. One wants to play with a toy bulldozer. It's outdoor time at the St. Mary's Hospital Child Care Center in Madison. Christine Cook runs the center. She apologizes for her cluttered office and explains that lately she's been in the classrooms teaching.
Because I don't have anyone to hire.
Cook's had a position posted for 7 months. She could actually use two more teachers, but she can't even find the one. Cook's been director here for the last 3 years, and during that time, she's seen the number of child care workers plummet.
And I think now, well, now why are we not stable when I'm in this position, you know? And it's a sign of the times.
It's actually a sign of a good economy with low unemployment. Ruth Schmidt is the director of the Wisconsin Early Childhood Association. She says the state's workforce depends on child care.
And yet, it's one of these sort of odd scenarios where the stronger Wisconsin's economy is, unfortunately, the harder it is to keep people working in early childhood programs.
That's because benefits are poor and wages are low. In Wisconsin, the average child care worker earns $10.33 an hour. That's not enough to keep a family of four out of poverty. Yet child care teachers are, on average, more educated than the Wisconsin workforce. All over the state, child care directors are struggling to find and keep qualified teachers. About 3 out of 10 teachers leave their jobs each year, taking positions at public schools or retail chains like Quick Trip and Walmart. Jillian Clemens taught preschool for nearly a decade. Early on, she realized her salary wasn't sustainable.
Because I loved it and I was passionate about it, I at first was like, okay, I'll figure this out. I'll get a second job because this is what I want to do. This is who I am. This is literally a part of my person, right? Like I could feel it in my bones that I was going to be a teacher for the rest of my life.
Eventually, Clemens couldn't make the numbers work. She now works on policy and programs related to children and families. But she says that every day she misses the kids and how they learn.
They're like planting all these seeds for themselves, right? And they're learning. And it's just so, it's so cool.
Where's the car coming? This is a car.
At St. Mary's Child Care Center, run by Christine Cook, toddlers sing their ABCs and build important social-emotional skills through play.
A, B, C, D.
Research shows a child's first 5 years are crucial for brain development. What young children learn and experience stays with them for life.
TV.
But childcare professionals say their compensation doesn't match the science. The government does not support childcare in the same way it supports K-12 education, and centers can't afford to pay their teachers more. They have large expenses, and they'd have to charge families higher tuition. Christine Cook and others say society doesn't understand or respect the field enough.
Early childhood is not recognized as something more than just babysitting, taking care of kids for the day.
And right now, childcare providers are paid like babysitters, not like teachers. And until that changes, more teachers will likely leave the profession, and more centers will have to turn families away or shut down altogether. Phoebe Petrovic, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, in his new state budget plan, Governor Evers is targeting the Republican-backed labor law known as Right to Work. An expert on labor politics looks at the nationwide back and forth over union laws and how things might play out here in Wisconsin. Hemp farming is returning to Wisconsin after changes in both state and federal law. We'll find out how farmers around the state are getting ready to bring a new, old crop into their mix. And we'll meet a Wisconsin social worker turned doll maker who's making special dolls for children with disabilities. You can get a head start on that labor conversation, by the way. Head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let us know, should Wisconsin's Right to Work law be repealed? How about parts of Act 10, the one that affected public employees? Let us know. Tell us what you think on the Ideas Network Facebook page. All that and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 6, millions of baby boomers are retired or about to retire. Many of them don't have enough savings. Kate talks to the author of the new book, Downhill from Here, Retirement Insecurity in the Age of Inequality. That's tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's the news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then Governor Evers has called for the state to expand Medicaid or Badger Care coverage here in the state. We'll hear about the impact the program's expansion could have if it ends up being approved by lawmakers. Not a sure thing. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.